Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has overruled the scientific opinion of the Food and Drug Administration on a morning-after contraceptive pill. It had been deemed safe enough to be sold without a prescription and without age restrictions. But yesterday's ruling means teens 16 and younger will still need a prescription. NPR's Julie Rodner reports on a political debate stretching back years.
In 2003, two FDA advisory committees voted overwhelmingly to make the morning-after contraceptive pill known as Plan B available over-the-counter to women of all ages.
It's always been known to be quite safe. There are no contraindications for its use at all. If someone is already pregnant, it does not cause an abortion.
Atsuko Koyama is a pediatrician and emergency room doctor at the Boston Medical Center. She says the teenagers she sees in her ER are quite capable of knowing what to do with the medication.
I have had patients who are 15, 16 years old who come into the ER asking for Plan B. So, you know, they're taking responsibility for their health and their future.
But the FDA didn't follow its advisors' recommendations back then, which was unusual. Many women's health groups and members of Congress charged that the Bush administration's decision was politically motivated. Susan Wood, the FDA's assistant commissioner for women's health, ended up quitting her job in disgust.
That was part of a series of blockages that had occurred, which clearly was showing FDA being overruled and not being allowed to do its job and make its decisions based on their interest in the public health and in women's health.
Finally, in 2006, the FDA decided to make the pill available without a prescription to those 18 and over, but still require younger teens to see a doctor first. A judge later lowered to 17, the age at which a prescription would not be necessary. But the impact of that split approval means that the product isn't really available over the counter, even for adults, Wood says, because they still have to ask for it and show ID. And with this latest decision, that won't change.
For all women of all ages who are in an urgent situation, they still have to go find an open pharmacy and ask permission of the pharmacist or the pharmacy clerk to have access to this product.
It was that hope of making emergency contraception much easier to get that has outraged not just people like Susan Wood, but women's health advocates like Kirsten Moore. She's president of the Reproductive Health Technologies Project.
I was in the East Room of the White House in March 2009 when the president signed an executive order saying this administration was committed to restoring scientific integrity to the policymaking process. And that commitment just went up in smoke today.
Not everyone is unhappy, however. Conservative groups have long favored keeping the age restrictions in place. Jeannie Monahan is with the Family Research Council.
So I think that most reasonable people will agree that a young girl who's sexually active seeing a medical professional is a positive thing.
No one can remember a case before of an HHS secretary stepping in to overrule a scientific opinion made by FDA. And now the administration is facing yet another contraception-related decision, whether to back away from new rules requiring most religious employers to include contraception in their health insurance plans. Catholic leaders have already met personally with President Obama to lobby for the change. Kirsten Moore says she's no longer confident the administration will fight for its own rules.
When there's political pushback, they back down.
The decision on the contraceptive rules is expected any day. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
And now a tragic story that's revived concerns about hazing on campus. Robert Champion Jr. was a 26-year-old drum major at Florida A&M University's legendary marching band, the Marching 100. He died after he was found unresponsive on a band bus in November. Florida A&M's longtime band director Julian White is on paid administrative leave as the police investigation continues. The school has also moved to expel four students connected to the case. Now Champion's parents are speaking out and saying that Florida A&M officials did not do enough to prevent the hazing that they believe was responsible for their son's death. They say they're planning to file a lawsuit against the school. And Pamela and Robert Champion Sr. are with us now. Thank you both so much for speaking with us. And as I said, I'm so very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Could I start by asking either of you why you believe that hazing was responsible for Robert's death?
Pretty much there's a lot of different stories and information that's going out. What we are hearing now that hazing was a part of it. So basically, it's just the information that we're getting through the news media that they came to the conclusion that it was had to do with the hazing.
Had Robert ever complained to either of you or spoken to either of you about hazing being part of his life before he died? Because I have to tell you that one of the things that's puzzling and surprising to many people, maybe it shouldn't be surprising, is that I know that people have heard a lot about hazing in connection with fraternities and sororities and sometimes even sports teams. But I don't know that a lot of people were familiar with hazing as a part of like a group like the Band. So had he ever talked about this before?
No, he haven't. There have been times where my son and I had conversation on the telephone, and I always try to ask him what's going on and anything that I need to know. And not once he ever mentioned to me anything about hazing.
You've been vocal since this tragedy occurred, and you've talked to a number of people in the media and certainly talked to the authorities about hazing. That has to be difficult. What is it that causes you to speak out?
We're speaking out because we want to, in my son's name, to be able to put a stop to it, to end all the hazing. Now that the door has been opened and we can see all the things that are behind that door, I think it needs to be cleaned out and stopped. And I think that speaking out, making it people aware of what it is and what happens and the damages and the things that it can do to not only the individuals but to the family and the people and to the school. We have put together a Facebook that is called John Major for Change, Robert D. Champion. And the purpose of that Facebook is for people to go onto that Facebook and maybe share their stories, leave comments. We're also looking at putting in place a hotline, an anonymous hotline, so a student would have a place to call in and to seek help if they are involved or in the middle of or going into any type of haze. Our goal is to rid the campuses of hazing.
Mr. Champion?
Yes. We wanted to speak out because in the last few days since my son's death, there have been people come to me telling me things about the problem they've been having themselves and asking me, Mr. Champion, this is time that we need to do something to stop this. Our job now is to carry our son's name on and try to do something about the problem because this is a problem not only at my son's school, but these problems all over the world. It's even in the high school. So now is the time where we need to speak and address the problem.
Do you have any idea what exactly or what is believed to have led to your son's death? Because I'm just having a hard time picturing. First of all, I have to say the job of drum major is not an easy one. It's a leadership position. It requires a tremendous level of physical fitness. Do you have any idea what exactly is alleged to have occurred that led to his death?
Well, we don't have any idea. We know about as much as what you're hearing on the media. And until all the evidence and everything that comes out, then we will know because we really don't know what happened.
Finally, before we let you go, and I thank you both again for speaking to us at such a difficult time, could you just as a final thought, just tell us whatever else you'd like us to know about your son, just so that the last thing we think of him and hear from him is not how he died, but how he lived. Tell us something about him.
Well, and I'll let my husband address as well, but my son was a lover of music. And that, from an early age, he showed the signs of being talented in music. So what we did was just paved the way for him to excel in music. But he loved music, and he not only loved music, he was a Christian. He loved God. So Robert, his demeanor, as we stated before, was a humble one. He always seeked out and assist anyone in any way that he could. Robert never met a stranger. Everyone that he met was his friend. Anyone that you will talk to that knew Robert will tell you that he not only was their friend, but he made an impact on their lives. The thing is that he had so much talent. He had so much to give. Everyone that he touched, he always left them with something that was positive.
Mr. Champion?
Yes, well, I'm going to remember my son. Actually, I'm very proud of him and the accomplishment that he had made to the schools and all of the organization that he had participated in. I'm proud of him because I seen a young boy grow up to be a young man and try to make a difference. and he just opened the door now. So we want to address the problem and let people know that we're going to do all we can to get this hazing thing stopped so no other kid will have to go through what he went through.
Pamela and Robert Champion Sr. are the parents of Robert Champion Jr. He is the Florida A&M University drum major who died in a suspected hazing incident in November. The Champions joined us from their home in Decatur, Georgia. Mr. and Mrs. Champion, I thank you so very much for speaking with us. I'm so very sorry for your loss, and I do thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
We'd also like to let you know that we reached out several times for comment from Florida A&M University officials. We have not yet received a response.
Newspaper correspondent Ernie Pyle reported from the front lines of World War II. His dispatches often read like letters home from the troops. Pyle's columns won him the Pulitzer Prize, his life made it to the silver screen, and in a rare honor for a civilian, he was even awarded a Purple Heart. Pyle was born and raised in a tiny Indiana town where a once expansive museum pays tribute to him. But as Sarah Whitmire of member station WFIU reports, that museum now faces perhaps its greatest challenge.
Before Ernie Pyle became a renowned war correspondent for Scripps Howard News Service, he lived here in Dana, Indiana, a farming town of 400 near the Illinois border. As soon as you come into town, you're pointed to the one thing that would bring you here, the Ernie Pyle Museum. Philip Hess is on the board of directors for the Friends of Ernie Pyle. He's standing on the steps of the visitor center.
Would you like to take the whole tour? Mm-hmm. I'd like for you to.
Sure.
This is his birthplace.
The private tour through Pyle's boyhood home offers an early 20th century glimpse into the life of one of America's most famous journalists. It winds through the sitting room into Pyle's parents' room and onto the kitchen and the living room. From there, you go outside and into the visitor center, a connected pair of restored Army Quonset huts from World War II. Throughout the exhibit, life-size tableaus depict some of Pyle's most famous columns.
This is a picture of the beach as it was when Ernie came ashore at Normandy, one day after the invasion.
And when you press a button, actor William Wyndham's voice comes on and reads the article.
I took a walk along the historic coast of Normandy in the country of France. It was a lovely day for strolling along the seashore. Men were sleeping on the sand, some of them sleeping forever. Men were floating in the water, but they didn't know they were in the water, for they were dead.
Pyle was known for putting a human face on war, befriending and traveling with the troops until he was killed by a sniper in 1945 near Okinawa. After his death, Dana residents began collecting stories and artifacts to put on display here. The state staffed the museum. That was up until last year. Indiana was spending more than $40,000 on the museum, which was drawing about 2,000 visitors a year. Historical Sites Vice President Bruce Beasley says the state simply couldn't justify the museum's costs.
We needed to make a decision on what was the most effective and efficient ways to tell the Ernie Pyle story.
Indiana officials determined the best way to tell Pyle's story was to cherry-pick the best things from the site. Everything from his field typewriter to his famous Zippo lighter with the initials EP carved into it, and display them in the State Museum in Indianapolis. Hess was told that more people will visit the Pyle exhibit there in 1 year than would have traveled to Dana in 100. While he doesn't dispute that, he says it's just not the same.
In Indianapolis, they see who Ernie Pyle was. Here you get to feel what his writing was about. And a fair number of people who see the exhibits leave here in tears.
The Ernie Pyle Museum is back under the ownership of the Friends Group, which opens it to the public in the summer or by appointment. And now, before you exit the Quonset huts, you pass by a large donation box marked with these words, "Help keep the site open." For NPR News, I'm Sarah Whitmire.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, a game of football that was decided by a fist. Boston's Cathedral High trailed Blue Hills in the final minutes of a division championship game on Saturday. Matt Owens, the Cathedral quarterback, took the ball on an end-around and broke free. He sprinted practically untouched for a game-winning 56-yard touchdown, or so he thought. As he ran around the 25-yard line, the exuberant Owens briefly raised his fist in the air in celebration. And that fist, the referees said, was a little too exuberant. A flag was thrown for excessive celebration. The touchdown was called back. On the next play, Owens threw an interception. There were a few minutes left in the game, but that ended his team's best scoring chance, and Cathedral High lost. The outcry over the referee's call was just beginning, though, and joining me now on the line is Bob Holmes. He's the high school sports editor for the Boston Globe. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
First question, was the call that the refs made correct? Was the quarterback actually violating a rule against celebrations?
It was absolutely correct. It's when you throw in all the emotional stuff that goes with it, that's when it gets foggy, that's when it gets a little tough to handle for a lot of people, but it was the right call.
Tell me about the rule, and is it a rule that coaches and players all knew about?
They absolutely all knew about it. It's a relatively new rule this year, and Massachusetts is one of two states, along with Texas, that follows the NCAA rulebook. And the goal here is to keep those silly celebrations that we all see on Sunday with the NFL from trickling down to both college and high school. It was really a black-and-white issue. You're not allowed to raise your hand like that. I think the official probably feels like the Christmas Scrooge right now, but I think he did the right thing.
But on the interception play that followed, the defending team, these guys are all raising their hands, and the fellow who intercepted the ball runs off the field raising his fist or wagging his finger, but that's not a violation.
Yeah, there are a lot of crazy things, too, and if you follow most plays, even in high school, the running back runs into the end zone, and even if the running back does nothing, usually if you look behind them 10 yards, the offensive linemen are raising their hands up. And that, you would think, would be a violation and certainly worse than raising your hand for the moment. But the difference is the linemen do not have possession of the football.
The player with possession of the football who is scoring may not celebrate.
He may not.
Well, Boston is known for, how shall I put it politely, uninhibited and expressive sports fans who speak their minds. What is in the air today about this, or in the past couple of days about this decision? What do people think of it?
It's all the emotions that this quarterback had, you know, the thrill of his lifetime pulled from him. How dare they do that? And again, that's, you know, I understand that. It makes sense. It's the emotional side of things. But really the buzz is that this kid was wronged by the system.
Is the rule clear enough so that when you're watching Matt Owens on the video run downfield, you can tell at what point his arm is raised high enough to be a penalty, or could he have held his arm out laterally and not been in violation, or just held a thumb up or something like that?
Oh, that is a great, great question. And these things happen so quick. You know, there's really no time for the official to judge this. You have to assume the official was running right beside him and didn't think it was just an involuntary arm shooting off to the side. But boy, that's a gray area, and to an extent, I think it took a lot of guts to throw the flag as well.
Well, is the man who threw the penalty flag, is he now in the high school football officials' official protection program in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I think he must be. For the most part, he's been silent. Nobody's heard from him. His name has not been publicized, and that's probably a good thing because I'm guessing he wouldn't get much fan mail or Christmas presents from anyone at Cathedral. You know, I'm guessing that the football officials, his fellow football officials out there, are probably applauding his decision.
Well, Bob Holmes, thanks for talking with us about it.
Oh, thank you very much.
That's Bob Holmes, high school sports editor for the Boston Globe.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Robert Siegel. There's an ironic twist to the publication of John Lewis Gaddis's new biography of George F. Kennan. For decades, Kennan was America's most famous diplomat, the country's top Russia scholar, the author of the Cold War-era policy of containment of the Soviet Union. Even in retirement, when Kennan spoke, ambassadors and secretaries of state trembled and rushed to do damage control. Professor Gaddis, who is a Yale historian of the Cold War, had access to Kennan's diaries, even a dream diary, and the agreement was to publish after Kennan's death. Kennan lived to be 101. He died in 2005, and that's the irony. By the time Geddes' book, George F. Kennan, An American Life, came out last month, Kennan, a man who for so many years needed no introduction, had become someone unfamiliar to a generation of American readers. Professor Geddes, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert.
And for the benefit of younger listeners, by that I mean, say, people under 40, in a nutshell, who is George F. Kennan?
Well, if you had to single out one individual who probably did more than anyone else in coming up with the big idea of how the second half of the 20th century could be less dangerous than the first half was, I think Kennan would be right up there at the top of the list.
Yes, we should explain that containment may have been decried from the left as a policy that provoked the Soviet Union into a Cold War that might have been avoided. And from the right, it was something far short of what was really needed, liberation of nations held captive to communism. But really, after the Second World War, this was a way of saying the U.S. doesn't have to give in to Stalin and Moscow and everything, and that doesn't mean we have to have World War III.
That's correct. Within the context of the end of World War II, when we went through this abrupt transition of the Soviet Union having been our glorious ally and then suddenly emerging as an unexpected adversary, many people did see only two choices, and one was World War III, and the other was appeasement of the kind that had indeed led to World War II. So what Kennan showed was the middle path between those two extremes.
And if the U.S. took that middle path, as Kennan saw it, it would not respond to every Soviet or every communist advance in the same way. It would decide, where should we check Stalin's advances? Where is it worth it? Where can we succeed?
I think that's right. We had to decide in our own minds, as Kennan saw it, first of all, what was important to our security, and he did not believe that maintaining some kind of a global military presence was that important. But he also had a second idea, and this was that Stalin, although he is a totalitarian, he's not Hitler. He does not have some kind of fixed timetable for aggression. And so if you put these two things together and then add one third component, which is the illogic of the Soviet system, Kennan was arguing there was time. If you could be patient, the Cold War could eventually end peacefully. And really to a remarkable extent, yeah. In 1946, 1947, he sees how it ends in 1989, 91.
Now, I want to play you something that George Kennan said on NPR in 1993. When he was already pushing 90, he was despairing of the influence of politics on the making of foreign policy during, as he said, during 26 years in the Foreign Service.
We were supposed to be acting in the national interest and to report to our government, to inform our government as to where the national interest was with relation to given countries. And for that reason, it's been very hard for many of us who are in the career to forgive our government for its flaccidity and its weakness in the face of special political interests.
What are you hearing there?
Well, I hear someone who is in very good shape as he's pushing 90. But I hear something else that was a major theme in George's life, which was his extreme distrust of democracy. It's paradoxical because history will regard him, I think, as one of the greatest defenders of democracy for the containment strategy. But George himself was extremely impatient with democracy because he saw it as interfering with the kind of precise thought that would be necessary to conduct an intelligent foreign policy.
He seems also to have despaired of American consumerism, American highways, automobile traffic, American big city life, American culture, and generally Americans.
I think it's fair to say that George Kennan holds some kind of record for despair. He was never comfortable with what he was doing, particularly if it involved his own country and his own culture. But I think what he tried to do was to hold America to impossibly high standards.
Professor Geddes, one of the most appealing and impressive things about George Kennan as he emerges from your biography is that his approach to foreign policy analysis went way beyond smart and even creative. He was imaginative. He wrote like a novelist. He wrote poetry very often. Mm-hmm. And he thought you could understand Russia better by reading Chekhov and Dostoevsky than by reading Marx and Lenin.
Absolutely. He drew enormous influence from Russian novelists and writers of the 19th century, so Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and especially Chekhov. George regarded himself in the end as a failure in life because he never completed his biography of Chekhov, and that's what he really wanted to do.
He was a very tormented soul in many ways. He seems to be a man who was programmed to feel that he wasn't doing good enough.
Well, I think you're right on target, and this is partly a Calvinist upbringing in Milwaukee. But I think the real key to it is something that he mentioned to me the very first time we talked about the biography. He said, you have to understand that it's very important that my mother died 2 months after I was born and that I was scarred for life by not having a mother. And I think that's the key to understanding much of his inner torment.
I'm trying to understand the arrangement with George Kennan that this book be published posthumously. That was something that you worked out. You worked out many decades ago.
Yes, we did.
How old was George Kennan when he said, okay, but wait till I'm dead?
George was 78. I was 40. We both felt strongly that the only way that you can write a good biography is to write it with the guarantee the subject of the biography will not read it. The only thing that surprised us both when we made this deal in 1978 was that we thought it would be coming out at some point, surely in the next decade or so. And it never occurred to either of us that he would live for 30 more years. And of course, George, being George, regarded his longevity as a grave personal failing. So I would repeatedly, in the last 20 years or so, get phone calls in which he would apologize profusely for living and thereby delaying the biography.
I have to say that since nearly every chapter seems to include a hospitalization or a serious illness, the notion that he would break 100 is not entirely obvious, or wouldn't
it
be obvious.
It is not entirely obvious, not at all. And yet he was a pretty robust character in the long run.
Well, Professor Gaddis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
That's a Professor John Lewis Gaddis of Yale University. He is the author of George F. Kennan, An American Life.
This is NPR News. A federal expert panel says that most prostate cancer these days should not be called cancer at all. Most of these tumors would never threaten the lives of the men who have them. So, the panel says, most men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer should be given the choice of postponing treatment. NPR's Richard Knox has the story.
It's kind of a startling pronouncement. The most common cancer in men may, most of the time, not really be cancer.
Cancer equals death for most people. Everything that is labeled cancer by the medical community does not have the same meaning for the patient.
That's Dr. Patricia Gans of the University of California, Los Angeles. She led the panel, which was convened by the National Institutes of Health. The group says that up to 70% of men with newly diagnosed prostate cancer have tumors that don't necessarily need immediate surgery and radiation because they're so slow growing. That's as many as 168,000 men a year.
We feel sufficiently confident for these very low-risk cancers that this is one that's not going to move very fast. And there's no urgency to treat it with curative intent.
And yet only 1 in 10 of these men are currently given the choice of putting off treatment and monitoring the situation to see what happens. Gans says it'll take time to bring around many doctors to the idea that most prostate cancers don't necessarily need to be treated.
There obviously are financial motivations. You know, if someone's going to get paid for surgery or radiation, we also heard that wives and family members are often saying, you know, what you waiting for? You know, just get it cut out. You know, there's no big deal.
The expert panel wasn't convened to save the government money, and Gans says she went into the deliberations not thinking she would come out the way she did. But she was persuaded by the evidence, especially by a new, still unpublished study of 700 men who got either surgery for prostate cancer or something called watchful waiting. Dr. Timothy Wilt of the University of Minnesota led that study.
Our study, along with others, have demonstrated a very low risk of dying from prostate cancer over 15 years, and that surgery does not reduce that risk.
Wilt says most men diagnosed with prostate cancer are in their 60s and beyond, so the study shows surgery isn't likely to extend their lives.
If there was any benefit, it would have to be exceedingly long distance in the future, yet men still would have to endure the consequences of the harms associated with treatment.
Those harms include sexual problems and difficulty controlling urinary and bowel function. He agrees that low-risk prostate tumors should be called something other than cancer. Idle tumors, perhaps.
The fact of the matter is that when somebody gets labeled with a diagnosis of cancer, there are all sorts of terms that are used for that. Fight the battle, win the war, military terms.
That kind of thinking may be obsolete, but Albany urologist Barry Kogan says the argument shifts a little bit for men his age, under 60. They have a longer life expectancy.
For me, it would probably be a coin toss.
He agrees treatment may not be necessary for older men with low-risk tumors, but when he was diagnosed a couple of years ago with a slightly higher-risk prostate cancer...
I did have radical surgery to treat it.
The point is, not all prostate cancer is the same, and it shouldn't be treated that way. Richard Knox, NPR News.